And we are back, and it has been too long. So without further ado, let's kick off all of our favorite parts of the show, the interview segment. And we are joined by our guy, our maven of macro research himself, Mr. Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro. Chase, how the heck are you, man?
Oh, doing great. How's it going?
Good, good. Does it bother you with my introductions? Because my introductions aren't nearly as formal as, you know, the hedge fund manager that runs like Macro Voices podcast, right? Is that a suitable introduction, Chase, or do you need me to kind of put a bow tie and a tux on that for you?
No, this is more than fine. I actually recorded earlier today with Real Vision, and they asked me if I wanted to be called CEO. And I was like, yeah, I'm running like a really small LLC. I don't want to be called CEO. Thanks. That was weird to me when guys run a very, very tiny business and refer to themselves as president and CEO or something. So,
you know, what's
the less formal, the better.
Yeah. We're not so small anymore. And I still feel the same way about CEO. It just feels like a self-indulgent, right? I am the CEO of my own castle, right? Anyway, so did you do an interview? Was it a video type deal or just audio?
Video. It'll be out next week, early next week, Tuesday, I think.
You went big time on us, man. You're going to be on Real Vision.
Oh, yeah. Total celebrity. Yeah.
I got to get some autographs.
Yeah, I should start calling myself CEO or something.
Yeah, yeah. That's big time though, man. That's congratulations. I need to get like a freeze.
Know your risk radio is big time.
Well, I mean, I think so, right? I mean, that's my take, you know. So anyway, okay. Before we get into this, there were some quick hitters that I wanted to throw at you. I'm laughing a little bit today because apparently over the last 24 hours, the global growth fears that were driving down a lot of the value type stuff and commodity type stuff, they've all gone away. So I guess the global growth picture has really picked up in the last 24 hours, huh?
Yeah, is that how that works?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's exactly
how it works. The last couple of weeks have been just a great opportunity for people to blow a lot of stuff out of proportion. So whether it's OPEC or the Fed. So yeah, it's kind of nice to see some stuff finding solid ground again.
It's really interesting to me though, because no matter what the economic reports are, it doesn't impact the Wall Street darlings, right? The tech, you know, they go up no matter what, right? Good economy, bad for them. Bad economy, good for them, right? It's kind of an all weather type investment. It works all the time. Stonks only go up, man. Okay, so moving more into the macro picture, you've put out a couple really good letters. Well, they're always good. I love your reading your letters and your info. Right now, I think the most pressing issue, and I'm sure you'd agree with me, is the deflation-inflation debate. All of this deflation chatter in the last week and a half has cracked me up because there literally is no data to support it. And before we get into that hardcore, you and I have talked a lot about rates. So we're going to get into deflation-inflation. But one of the things that I've thought about with rates for a long time is, can we glean the same information from rates as we have in the past? Because I look at something like the 10-year, and I will admit, Chase, I will say the three words that you're not supposed to say in this business ever, which is, I don't know. But I look at rates, and it's really hard for me to tell if rates are giving us signals like they have in the past, or if rates are just a product of where the Fed wants them to be. And so I bring that up because I saw the same thing a couple months ago when rates pulled back and everybody was saying, boy, you know, rates are pulling back here. You know, maybe there's some fears. And then you got to the end of the week and the Fed released their balance sheet and you realized that virtually all the buying that had driven rates down had been the Fed just ramping up purchases again. So the question I've got is, A, do you think rates are showing us what they've showed us in the past? Is it the same data point with the same value, or are they just an amalgamation of where central banks want them to be?
I think largely they are where central banks want them to be. I don't think it's the same as it used to be in the past, but I do still think there's a lot of, you know, economic value looking at them. But you know, whenever you have, but like post QE world, they're not quite the same as they used to be because there's just another huge buyer in the market, and that definitely changes things. And then when you throw in the added layer of the Treasury's general account, where they're ramping that up and then running it down by trillions of dollars, so that impacts how much issuance there is of Treasuries dramatically. That's another, you know, kind of really big thumb on the market. So whenever you overlay all of those things, like, that can quiet the pure signal in the noise that we're kind of, you know, we're all used to from, you know, where bond yields were really just showing us more, you know, growth and inflation versus growth and inflation and what the Fed's doing or the Treasury's doing with Treasuries. So it is less of a signal, but it's still plenty of a signal. And I still take it seriously when bond yields are going higher whenever that doesn't seem to make sense, or when they're going lower when it doesn't seem to make sense. So, and the other thing there is they really care a lot about rate of change of growth and inflation, sometimes more than, you know, pure levels. Even if that doesn't make sense, you know, where we were a year ago has a dramatic impact. So I think in the last month we've really started to peak for rate of change purposes anyways, for, you know, versus last year, compared to last year where we were at this time. We've peaked on growth and inflation, so it's going to start kind of fading. Growth and inflation are still going to be very high, higher than we're used to, but on a rate of change basis, they're going to start leaking lower, and I think bonds really care about that. I think, you know, we can all look at that and say they should care about the fact that we probably have a new higher level for growth and inflation than we're used to. We've been stuck in a kind of 0 to 2%-ish, you know, regime for the last 15, 20 years, where now maybe we'll be more like 1 to 4% for inflation, and then growth, you know, we've been stuck at 2% for a long time or a little less. And now I think you can see growth more like 3% as like kind of a new floor. And if all that's true, I think bond yields should care about the new levels. But for the time being, they really just care about that rate of change. You can tell the market doesn't think anything's actually changed kind of from a secular standpoint, a long-term structural way. And I think that's wrong, and that we have had a more of a change there than the market seems to respect.
I mean, the game has been changed. The other side of it, one of the things that we've been telling our clients, and time will prove that this is correct, which is I don't think that at all, I don't think we're on the cusp of some Weimar Republic type inflation. And the people that are calling for that, a lot of them
have,
are calling that
have
for,
been
last,
for a very
yeah,
long time.
Yeah, for like 13 years. And you know our joke, if you're 13 years early, you're wrong. Right. So, but I kind of think one of those, I think we're going to get serious inflation that's going to cause problems, but I don't think we're there yet. And the reason I say that is because I think we all do, when we get those deflationary scares, you know what the Fed and the U.S. government are going to do, right? I mean, they've propped this thing up for so long that ceasing to prop it up would in itself become the crisis. I don't know if would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the Treasury market, it requires Fed support and Fed buying, to really function. If the Fed were to take that away, then Congress would have to start cutting some spending in dramatic ways, which would hurt the economy and would hurt the stock market. That's really not a viable political option, which means it's not a viable option, period.
Yeah, that brings up, and I don't want to go off on the Fed here, but I always love it when any one of them gets on there and says that A, they've got nothing to do with the wealth gap, and B, the government's spending too much, especially the government spending too much. Because I look at them and I go, that's like, you know, I mean, that, you know, the Fed is essentially the bartender and they've overserved. I mean, they couldn't spend as much as they did if the Fed wasn't,
absolutely,
you know, squaring it away. And so you're sitting there going, yeah, they spend too much. Yeah. Why do they spend too much, guys? Because of what you do. You know, so that you take all the pain away. Okay. So now, moving over to the macro picture, and I got to believe this is what you were talking about with Real Vision, was it not? The inflation deflation argument?
Yeah, definitely a lot. And then, you know me, as usual, we talked a lot of energy.
Oh, yeah. Shocker, right? So anyway, where are we at, Chase, in this deflation, inflation? What are you seeing? I'll preface that by saying, in my own view, I think there is a rampant inflation. I think that's undeniable. I also think that some of the things that are being called inflation are products of supply chain crimps that will inevitably work themselves out. I think there are other things like lumber that are probably going to be more durable in terms of the inflation, right, or less transitory, to use Fed speak. What is your take, though? I know you look at this stuff a lot deeper, and quite honestly, whatever your take is going to be mine. What is your take on the inflation versus deflation and where we're currently at?
Yeah, it is very, you know, idiosyncratic. Different, all these different sources of inflation are just so different from each other now. And I mean, you mentioned lumber; it's actually 56% off its highs, which is sort of interesting in this market. Granted, that's fallen all the way back to what used to be like wildly high, so it's not exactly low.
Right.
And yeah, we have to build a lot more houses, so it may struggle to go a lot lower than here than where we're at now. I think there are some sources of very durable inflation, like energy, like probably food, and then there are sources that are just going to go away. You know, like a lot of the supply chain stuff with chips and with cars. House prices are going to start cooling off eventually. So you're going to see some of these areas that are very reopening driven get better. But it's going to take time. You look at all the order backlogs that everyone's dealing with, the kind of long lead times to get stuff out there. Everyone has, you know, giant inventories. They still have to restock. So there's underlying inflationary pressures that are going to take some time to work through. But I think the worst is over from a, like, let's get all the reopening going, getting the world back up and running, essentially. I think the worst is over for a lot of that, especially when you know, put in the base effects, the comparison to last year. The worst of that's over. So I think headline inflation will start to kind of fade. But I also think it's going to fade less than a lot of people expect, mostly for two reasons. One, I think wages can stay a little hotter than people expect. And I also think rents are going to kind of put a floor under inflation for a while. And for whatever reason, rent and owner's equivalent rent, so like house prices, roughly, you know, how much it costs to live in a home or an apartment or whatever, is a really significant chunk of our inflation metrics. And both due to base effects and like real life, no kidding, rents are going higher. You're going to see that number pretty high. And it's going to stay sticky for a while. So as a lot of this other, you know, reopening effects that are going to fade, it's almost like you hand the baton over to like rent inflation and then some. I don't see oil really going down or gas going down anytime soon. So that's going to, that, you know, energy costs are going to stay high. Food costs, I think, will stay reasonably high. So you get sort of a handing of the baton off, where maybe some people expect us to go from 5% back to, you know, 1 or something, and maybe I think it's more like 5 back to more like 3 or 3.5, which, you know, still historically for the last, you know, 15 years, call it, that's still pretty high. So it's definitely a complex story where you have a lot of moving parts, things that are way higher than they used to be, things are way lower than they used to be. So it is complicated because of the going in and out of the pandemic. But overall, I think we have a new higher floor for inflation in general. And that's not really being respected by the market now. And I think the market's going to have to kind of come to terms with that eventually.
Yeah, no, that's certainly gels with what we're seeing. And like I said, I think that if you get, you know, bouts or scares of deflation, the way I look at it is the Fed is just completely painted into a corner. They don't have a choice, right? If you get that scare, they have to come. Or this thing comes apart in a big hurry. So obviously that's not going to happen. Switching over to oil. And again, I'm going to lay out kind of my thoughts. And I'm not doing it because I think that my opinion on this stuff is as important as yours. Obviously, this is what you're dialed in on. But I just say it more to, you know, give you a base so you can agree or disagree. I look at oil right now here at 72, and I've heard people 72, 73 talking about, yeah, oil's run too far too fast. I look at it as the exact opposite. I don't see any evidence that the supply side has improved at all. The rig counts have gotten a little better, but I mean, they're, you know, they're not tracking the price of oil like they have in the past, certainly, which is understandable. And I kind of look at oil right now as just a coiled spring. I think that you could get shocking moves in oil, especially if you had some geopolitical issues prop up. And I'm one who believes that geopolitical issues, A, just being post-COVID, I think they're more likely. As the world has fragmented some and globalization has certainly receded. And then I also look at this administration. I think that this administration is probably it's less of a wild card maybe to the Chinese and the Russians, and it might embolden them a little bit to make some more political overtures. And I think that could happen in the Middle East as well. Bottom line is, I think it's a coiled spring, and I think if you got some geopolitical strife, you could see this thing skyrocket in a hurry. Does that jive with your picture? And if not, kind of give us your outlay on oil.
Sure. So I don't really concern myself with the geopolitical side. I just try to leave it out as an input personally. In fact, I hate when the price of oil spikes because of something geopolitical, because it makes it just kind of more difficult to analyze. So listeners that kind of understand what's been going on this last week, if they just kind of see some OPEC headlines and aren't really sure what's going on, OPEC had what everyone just kind of thought they would cruise to a new deal on adding about 400,000 barrels a day every month until the end of the year. So adding back about 2 million barrels a day for the rest of the year. So right now they're holding off a little less than 6 million barrels is what they're kind of keeping back. And they were going to give two of that back essentially. But because of the UAE disagreeing over, basically they wanted to be able to produce a little bit more in the future and have their kind of their floor raised a bit. And the Saudis didn't really want to deal with that because then other people would want, you know, the same treatment. To be fair to the UAE, like, they have invested a lot recently to increase their production. So they're definitely not wrong that, hey, we can produce more. We want to produce more. We should be able to produce more. But the Saudis wanted to extend this deal through the end of 2022, because currently it runs through April of 2022. And the UAE didn't really want to extend that far out on this whole like framework. So because of that, they're all just doing nothing at the moment, which they're supposed to. Nobody increase production moving forward is the deal. So at first, everyone got excited about this because they were like, oh, like, they're not even going to add that 400,000 barrels a day back. So that's super bullish. But then people were like, wait a second, this might mean people are going to cheat and just pump like crazy anyways, including UAE, who kind of floated the idea, like, we might just do this anyway. So then oil kind of started getting hit really hard based on that. And then yesterday we had just incredibly bullish data come out of the U.S. As far as inventories. And I have a stat for you on that. So over the last 4 weeks, that 4 week average of inventory draws is the highest in the history of about 40 year history of EIA's data. So we're seeing truly generationally historic inventory drawdowns for oil, for the last like week over week globally, withdrew 50 million barrels of oil in the globe. So, we're talking just huge inventory drawdowns right now globally. And that's with, you know, COVID still being a problem in parts of the world with the Delta variant. That's with, you know, some interesting constraints. In the U.S., gasoline is back at an all-time high as far as demand goes. Oil is basically kind of right at the old highs. And that's despite jet fuel not even being close to all-time highs yet. So whenever jet fuel kind of comes back like in full or close to it, U.S. oil consumption is going to be significantly higher than it's ever been in history. And this is after tons of people predicted like oil already having peaked for demand. And, you know, our population's not growing significantly versus places in Asia where it is and where the middle class is exploding and energy consumption is exploding. So this whole idea that we already peaked for oil consumption, it's going to prove to be just incredibly wrong. And a lot of people are going to get caught flat footed on that. And really they already are. I think it was BP that came out and said they thought oil demand had already peaked. And we'll be well over 100 next year, million barrels a day, in demand. And where that production comes from is kind of anyone's guess at this point.
Well, that was one of those things where I thought that's, and you and I talked about a lot. We talked about this a lot last fall. I mean, that was one of the reasons that both of us were pounding on the table for energy prices. Because, look, I respect other people's opinions. I think it's expensive to not respect other people's opinions. But that was research, and that was a view that I just could never wrap my head around. Like you said, I you know, if you think that oil demand has peaked, go look at airline travel, right? I mean, it's rebounded a good amount, but you're still way off pre-pandemic levels. I mean, the Canadian border is still closed, for God's sake, right? So I look at it and I'm like, and yet the supply side really, especially here with U.S. domestic production, I mean, it's nowhere close to being back to where it was. I'm with you. I still think that's a coiled spring. Let's move over to one of your other areas that you focused a lot on, and that, quite honestly, Tony Greer and I did a show a while back, and we talked about natural gas, and we both agreed that it had been like a white whale for us, like a Moby Dick type scenario, where I thought the setups looked so good in the past, only to get burned. How does Nat Gas fit into all this? We've seen a good rally. You've made some big gains on your Nat Gas purchases. Where do we go with Nat Gas from here? And, you know, what are the drivers?
Yeah, natural gas is really interesting because whenever I got very, very involved, March of last year, it was a story of falling U.S. production for me. That was like one of the big drivers because I knew shale was about to implode, and a lot of gas production in the U.S. is kind of associated with shale oil production, but not all of it. Like, there's a lot that you could just go in, you know, Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, places like that, and just go get gas. It has nothing to do with oil. And that, a lot of that has really come back because prices are doing well. So U.S. production is actually really high right now. But despite that, we're having good prices. And a lot of people that just trade natural gas based on U.S. production are bearish, because they see, you know, hey, this U.S. production is really high. Like, that's usually really bad for prices. But what we're having, and for folks that don't know, the U.S. electricity grid is the biggest source of electricity in the U.S. is natural gas. So whenever you think of demand, there are a lot of sources of demand, but one of the big ones is just pure electricity production. So when you think about this giant heat wave on the West Coast, which you guys have definitely... You guys up in the Seattle area and Portland area, like a lot of the listeners will know, like, hey, like this was a big deal. So people had their air conditionings running, and those that have air conditioning had it running in a way they really never have. And a lot of that is natural gas is feeding that electricity. So obviously there's a lot of demand this summer, more than normal. So normally in the summer, you kind of restock inventories and then you draw it down in the wintertime when the production is a lot higher, the consumption rather. And we're not really getting that. We're not getting a lot of new supply to kind of just hold on to and use during the winter. So if we have a bad winter, you can see, which I've talked a lot about, like, I think we could have a bad winter. And if that does happen, that I think you just get a really disorderly spike in natural gas prices. But even if not, then just demand is really high. In Europe, you're seeing just skyrocketing gas prices, and part of that is because they charge for carbon. So a lot of people are trying to get away from coal and are using more gas, or, you know, gas just costs more because of that. And they had a really nasty winter last year, so they kind of drew down all their supplies and were kind of running low. So naturally, the price is higher. Same in Asia, where demand is just through the roof, and they don't really have enough gas. So, and you know, in the U.S., we export a lot of natural gas via liquefied natural gas, LNG, to Asia and Europe. And we just make basically a new all-time high in LNG exports essentially every quarter. And that's going to keep happening. We keep bringing on new infrastructure to do that. And the demand is just absolutely there for LNG. We send a lot to Mexico as well. So you think about, you have these exports that are moving higher. You have electricity needs moving higher, so there's just a lot of demand kind of baked in the cake, and we're under the five-year average as far as our supply goes. And we could get to a dangerous level before the winter, and where we just really couldn't afford a bad winter.
Gotcha.
So those are kind of the main drivers of the market.
So you expect nat gas to keep, it's going to be volatile, it always is, but you expect it to keep pushing higher.
Absolutely. And the kind of the, when you look out, you know, sort of like the December futures contract, I mean, it's just exploded higher. But what the really stunning kind of chart to see is the European prices. I mean, they're just exploding.
And yet the stocks, I mean, we've had some decent movement, but the stocks really haven't responded to this. do you think that is a product of this new market paradigm we're in, where you got so many retail investors and everybody's just chasing tech? I think that this is an opportunity, but why from your side of it, don't you see, you know, how do you explain that? How do you rationalize the fact that you're not seeing the follow through, from your research, you're not seeing that follow through into the prices of these nat gas stocks?
So to me, and for what I own, I do see the follow through. I keep a little basket of my favorite, I think it's like 7-8 names, and it's up 75% on the year. So, I mean, it's July. So that, to me, that's fine. And one of my favorites, my biggest just like single holding is Antero Resources. And it's, you know, it's been one that has helped my bottom line on the year. It's up 175% on the year. So, and that's after being up about the same amount the last year. So.
Oh, okay.
I think they're doing fine. And some of the names, like if you get into the midstreams, kind of the pipeline plays, they won't move a lot, but they're usually paying you a yield of 5 to 10% to kind of accommodate for that.
Now, unless you bought Enterprise Partners when it was paying 11.5, I'm just saying.
Yeah. are you talking about their midstream?
Yeah, they're pipeline operators, and one of the biggest and cleanest. And you haven't seen, I think the position is up like 25, 30, maybe a little more than that, 35% since we bought it. But like I said, we're collecting 11.5% yield,
yeah, exactly,
on that thing. So, you know, I'll take that.
The 10-year yield at 1%, that ain't bad.
No. I don't want to get into this, but that continues to be another thing that has baffled me. And it, to me, it's an eventuality. But with rates the way they're at, savings accounts paying nothing, I'm shocked to see some of the yields out there available on some of these quality stocks. If I had to take a look back at the last 10 to 13 years since the financial crisis and yields, I think one of my biggest shockers that I still don't really have, I can't really wrap my head around, is I would have thought that in this interest rate environment, with these things paying the yields they are, I thought they would have been much more popular stocks to own. That still is a bit baffling to me.
One thing I'll add to that real quick that I kind of find interesting that I don't think enough people are taking into account. So, like, perfect example is coal, where a lot of folks will look at coal stock right now, and then they'll look at what last time the coal price was this high, this stock was 20x higher, but I think that leaves out the fact that a lot of people can't own these. Like, it's not just they don't want to own them. They literally can't. So if you take a look at all the assets under management globally, which is, you know, deep into the trillions of dollars, more than half of those assets under management have some sort of emissions tied into them. Like, whatever, if it's like a zero emission type thing where they can't own anything that hasn't met some guidelines. Obviously, your average natural gas or coal company or oil company doesn't fit into that, but that zero emission or, you know, lowering their emissions bucket. So
even though more than half
of the world's investable money can't go there. So that's going to limit price.
Even though a good chunk of the highest scoring ESG companies are energy producers. Have you seen that?
No. But this is kind of separate if you think about just from an emission standpoint. It's kind of separate from just ESG.
Like,
we all overuse ESG as to mean everything, but I guess we don't, because no one cares about the S or the G. But
well, and my whole thing is, I think that you're only another rally in energy away from a lot of those things going out the window. Because the bottom line is, when you can sit on tech companies and just make money hand over fist every single day, it's really easy to be a planet warrior.
Yeah,
and nature warrior.
Very true.
You start underperforming, you'll watch that flip really quick, right? It's amazing how quick Wall Street throws out those ethics when they go against them. Now, another one that is actually, you've gotten me in some trouble for this, pal. I've had to deal with some angry phone calls.
People hate making money.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, just so you know, the angry phone calls have quieted down quite a bit. but Cole, one of the best calls I've ever gotten from somebody, and you've given me a lot of good ones, but one of the best calls was about 2 months ago. I got a text from you that had one word and three letters, and it just said, "Bye, BTU." You're not one to send texts like that. I jokingly tell people that you're not one who's given to hyperbole. And I say that tongue in cheek because that couldn't be, you know, hyperbole and Chase Taylor, they don't fit in the same sentence. You're a very unhyperbolic guy. But that's one of the best calls I ever got. Buy BTU. We bought it at 370. I'm watching it tit today, 1106. That was 2 months ago. It's up 12.3% today alone. So again, buy it at 370. 2 months later, it's at 1106. The angry calls.
200%. Yeah.
Yeah. The angry calls have died down a lot. I told one of the guys, I go, "Look, if you would like me to allocate your gains to somebody else's account, I'm not sure we could do that. We could figure it out." No, Zach, I'm not saying that. And he's a great guy. We had a fun conversation. If he's listening, I'm not taking shots. Obviously when a trade works out that well, you know, there's some timing and luck involved, but what did you see and what, and I don't think you and I have dug into this. Certainly not, you know, in a conversation. I want to do two things. A, I want you to explain the macro drivers that you saw. I don't think you've ever sent a text like that before where you just said, "Buy this." And so I just did. What were the macroeconomic drivers? And then also, I think it's interesting to kind of walk through the anatomy of that trade because you hit it right on the nail. So first, let's look at the macro side of it, and then let's kind of pick through the trade and explain to people how you drilled that one so well.
Sure. So I'll just start with coal, and then talk about the actual just that name. But for coal itself, largely this really just comes down to it is very connected to global growth and is very connected to what is going on with natural gas prices, because especially in the U.S., if natural gas starts getting expensive, then utilities just jump over and start using a bunch of coal. Coal or gas has been so cheap for so long that they haven't really needed to. And we've closed a lot of coal plants in the U.S. So, I mean, it's just been in a brutal bear market for like a decade. So it kind of fell off everyone's radar. And I think we all assumed like, oh, coal's like a dead and dying industry. We probably use half as much coal as we did 20 years ago. In reality, globally, we use as much coal as we ever have. And I think that gets lost on folks in the West because we're closing our coal mines and our coal plants where the rest of the world's not. Like in the U.S. and in Europe, they are. But the rest of the world, they need more and more all the time. And it's something that it kind of slips through the cracks, I think, is even if you hate coal from an environmental standpoint, and frankly, we all should, it is brutal when it comes to emissions. But it's the most robust fuel there is. And what I mean by that is when it comes to the grid itself, wind stops blowing, water stops flowing, as sadly, you know, the West Coast is finding out with a lot of dams being below levels where they can supply hydro. I think we're down to like a third when it comes to hydroelectricity in California, this quarter compared to the first quarter of last year, which is awful. You know, so the sun doesn't always shine. And not only that, like if you look at the Texas freeze situation, they had a nuclear reactor that was down during that time, kind of it wasn't really connected, but nuclear reactors have to go offline to refuel, things like that. Or sometimes they have some maintenance issues. And then natural gas in Texas, they weren't winterized properly. So you had natural gas go offline. So I basically just named all the major, you know, ways we get electricity. And they all kind of have problems where they can go offline. Some of them, literally, it's part of the process for like wind, solar. Like every day, you're gonna get some lags. And you look at coal, and you really just need to shovel some more in, and then it's good to go. So it's a very, and you can store a ton of coal on site. You can't really do that with most sources of electricity. So it's very robust. It's nice to have, you know, kind of as in the background waiting to get turned on. And we do that with it. And I think we'll kind of always do that with it because it is so robust. If you value having your electricity, then you value coal, whether you realize it or not.
There's another thing that, and I explain this to several of our clients. There are certain things that I will not invest in for personal and moral reasons. I will not invest in anything pornographically related, anything that I think is exploitative of other people. And a client challenged me and said, well, why do you see coal differently? And I said, because there is an economic and human aspect of coal, which is there are a lot of places that use coal because they can't afford to use anything else. Right. And if they switch to something else, that would mean substantially higher energy prices, which means less people would have heat or light or electricity. Right. And I think that we can sit back here in the West on our high moral, you know, horse and, you know, make value judgments like that, that other people can't afford to make. Right. Where it's we either use coal or we can't power the house. Do we need to move away from coal? Yes. And that's going to happen in time. But in the meantime, there's still reason, you know, there's still a lot of people out there in the world that would be in a world of hurt if we did away with coal instantly. And I think that we in the West, we need to be a little more careful with how we think about the environment. Do we need to make, you know, I don't think, maybe there's some people out there, right? But I think everybody wants a clean environment and clean air and an LA without smog, right? Everybody, I think, is on board with that. But there's a real economic aspect and a real people aspect to the coal thing, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm of the personal view we should use it the least amount possible.
Right.
But I don't think – well, I should say this. Until we have truly affordable and robust battery technology, until we reach that point, which we're just not there and there's no obvious signs we're getting there soon, until you reach that point, coal is just super important to keep the lights on, whether you like it or not. Now, unless we – you know, had just widespread adoption of nuclear, which personally I'm fine with. But until you get that or like really good battery storage technology and affordable, like I say, then you're just not there and you literally need coal. Like not want coal, not it's nice to have. Like if you want lights, if you want electricity, then you have to have it. So I mean it at the end of the day it supports the living standards of billions of people and we should use it the least amount possible, but we have to use it. We should, places like China need to use it a lot less. There's just no doubt about that. But yeah, it's important. Go ahead.
No, the way I appreciate those statements and I agree with you wholeheartedly. The part of this the part of this debate or this conversation that just blows my mind is where natural gas fits in, right? The people that I hear this all the time. People that are anti coal. You know, they throw natural gas in that same basket. And I look at them and I go, just think about this for one second. You can leave all the burners on your stove on all day long and see no degradation of the air quality in your home. To throw natural gas in the same column as coal or even oil for that matter is ludicrous. In my opinion, if we want to be serious about the environment and emissions, I don't think you can get there without nat gas and nuclear. And I still am marveled when they go, well, yeah, but it's a fossil fuel. Who cares, right? If the whole world, if you converted all the oil and all of the coal type burning things and converted them over to natural gas, you'd see an unbelievable improvement in carbon emissions and all. I mean, wouldn't you? I mean, that's the thing. Yes. About nat gas that's never, I've never understood it.
It's like this. It's sort of the perfect bridge technology to get from where we are to where we want to go. We all want to go there. We all want to leave where we're at. But if you kind of ignore that as a bridge, then I mean, you're ignoring reality. The U.S. has been one of the global leaders in reducing emissions, and literally, it just kind of all comes down to one thing. We traded in a good bit of coal for natural gas, and that led to a dramatic reduction in our emissions. And if the rest of the, like if China switched literally all of their coal to natural gas, I mean, I haven't done the math, but what it would do for emissions globally would just be insane.
I know, and it's just like, no, you have to quit coal and you have to replace it with wind farms and solar. And you're just sitting there going, that doesn't work.
Literally doesn't work.
Does not work.
Because the grid would turn off every single night.
Yeah.
And you can't, I mean, if you don't want electricity every single night, then sure, like, let's just go renewables. But if you do like electricity at night or when it gets really hot or when the sun stops shining, then you still have to have this other base load power. And I think that's one of the big problems is people literally do not understand how the grid works. And that, and when I say people, I don't mean just, you know, a few like regular people. I mean legislators, regulators, obviously financiers that are, you know, don't want to give money to any of these other sources. I think people really think you could just turn everything into windmills and solar farms and everything would be fine. And that's just not how it works.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing is that, and I don't want to turn this into a political discussion, but I think that the United States and the world in general would be a lot better off if they came to the realization that the best and brightest are not the ones leading our country and making decisions. And if you need proof of that, go Google. What's the name of that island out there in the Pacific? Go Google. There's a video out there where a congressman that's still in Congress was grilling this military guy about, I believe he was a general or a colonel in the army, but was grilling them about over putting too many troops and too much military buildup on this island that could potentially cause the island to capsize. Did you ever see that video?
I know what you're talking about.
Okay, these are the people making energy decisions. Okay, just keep that in mind. And it's this all or nothing approach, right? Like you were referencing, and the Nat gas, again, it's just a mind bender to me where I'm sitting there going, look, do we have to hop through your microscopic moral hoop, or is the goal to reduce emissions and improve the environment, right? If that is the goal, then there are many things that we can do, right? They may not fit into your nice little, you know, Winnie the Pooh, green energy little hoop that you want to thread the needle through. But if you really want to improve things, there's a variety of different ways to go about doing that. And I think Nat gas is a big part of that.
Absolutely.
Where are we at on the nuclear side of things? We've seen a good run up here in the uranium-based stocks. I think our uranium portfolio is up about 130, maybe more than that. If we average it all together, maybe about 150% over the last 8 months or so, maybe a little more. So we've seen a good run. Haven't seen really a reaction, right? The uranium prices have improved on the margin, but, I mean, there hasn't been a huge pop. Where are we at in that? Are we at a point where the uranium stocks need to follow through, or we could be in some trouble, or do you think we're getting ready for a breakout in uranium?
So we've had a pullback, I'd say, the last one, like 4 or 5 weeks, about 15% in kind of your average uranium stock. And I think it makes sense. And I think I could see another 10%, you know, correction, like from where we're at. So like a 25% kind of peak to trough drawdown, I think is very possible. I think there's cooling off and digesting. Yeah, with the dollar kind of firming up a little bit and the reflation trade sort of at least leaking a little bit, it just makes sense for them to calm down. But all of the fundamental drivers that are going to make this trade continue to be a great trade, they're all still there. So for me, I just buy whenever there's bigger and bigger pullbacks. It's just an opportunity to add is the way I see it. The actual spot price of uranium, we're at about $33 now, which is solid, but still have a long ways to go before the market really catches fire. We still haven't had a big price spike in the spot market, and we still haven't had a big takeoff in the contracting cycle. And those are the two things, and they kind of feed on each other. And those are the two things that are going to really drive this bull market. So as long as those two things kind of are stuck in neutral, then it's really the market's going to be driven by what's the dollar doing and what's, you know, how the overall reflation trade's going. This is going to kind of follow that, but still love uranium and think we're headed much higher, you know, in the next 10 years.
Okay. Now, one other thing, and I know we're pressed for time. You got about what, 4 or 5 more minutes?
I'll give you 8.
Oh, you're what a champ. okay. So have you dug in to the infrastructure bill at all that they're working on. Have you taken a look at that at all?
I have. If you mean the bipartisan one.
Yes. Yes. What do you see there? Do you see any drivers? Do you see anything interesting? Do you see anything investable? I have not given it a close look. I've read mostly commentary about it and just kind of looked at it on the periphery. I haven't dug into it. What do you see there? Do you think there's any movers in that infrastructure plan?
Not really. It's relatively small because they just can't get a big one through. So it's pretty small. A lot of the pay-fors are just kind of just pixie dust. It's made up money that's not real. So the new dollars being spent on it are going to be a few hundred billion. It's not even, it's nowhere near a trillion of new money spent. As far as the actual, where the money is going, a lot of it's traditional, just kind of like road, bridge type stuff. Like, yes, you can make money on that, but I think a lot of people were pricing a lot of the stocks that will benefit from that for more like $2-3 trillion. And we're just not getting that. So I don't really see any of that as being any good trades coming up. And from a macro standpoint, I think this is obviously showing us that new large fiscal is just impossible now. So the fiscal impulse is going to keep fading until at least, midterms and minus, a big economic problem where it's an emergency spending. But we're showing right now that the composition of the Senate isn't enough to drive significant new fiscal stimulus, and that means growth and inflation will be a little less than a lot of us thought was possible maybe 9 months ago.
Okay, so that was kind of my reading on it. I don't think there are any movers, but I do think that's kind of the first salvo. I don't think that's what we're going to see. I was kind of laughingly thinking to myself while I was listening to you answer that question that the reason it's not bigger is because the stock market's too high. Right. Meaning if you get a good stock market scare, it's amazing how quickly those politicians will back away from their calls for fiscal discipline, which I think are pretty hilarious. Right. We're going to blow all this money and hand it out to everybody. But when it comes to infrastructure spending, no, we got to, fiscal restraint. That's the name of the game. Right.
Pretty much have three blue dog Democrats sort of running the Senate right now. At the end of the day, they're the ones that are going to thumbs up or thumbs down anything that gets through there. And they, at least at the moment, they are definitely a lot more fiscally conservative than where we were in the emergency times. For whatever reason, politically, that's their mandate, and so that's where we're at for now.
Yeah. Okay, so what else are you paying attention to and watching here in this final, we got 5 minutes left. Let's close it up with other things that you are watching and looking at of note that you think are going to be interesting over the next 6 months or so.
Yeah, a good friend of mine, Jason, he keeps talking to me about Children's Place. And I think this is like an area where obviously anything that kind of sells like back to school stuff is just like an interesting thing to take a look at. We haven't really been able to have a lot of back to school spending, obviously, because a lot of, kids haven't gone back to school or have on a limited basis or something. And if you just look at kind of household balance sheets, where they're at, when it comes to like debt servicing costs for the average household, things like that. The average household's doing just phenomenal, better than really the last 25 years. So people have money to spend right now. If you start just thinking like, okay, what will people spend money on? I think you could argue like kids' clothes makes sense as a thing people can spend money on. So it's just one like small idea, something to think about, not really super macro oriented, but it's something that kind of makes sense to me.
No, that makes sense. I like targeting those kind of niche type of things that can often be overlooked, and especially if it doesn't have anything to do with tech, right? Just because you throw a tech name on something right now, and I was joking with our private company that we're investors in. We had a board meeting the other week, and I was jokingly telling the guys I thought we should change our name. The company, change it to Tectonic Tech or something like that, right? Just because we'd probably increase the multiple on it by like 5x. I'm trying to think of what else I need to cover here with you. Oil stocks. We've covered oil. I still think these oil stocks are Yeah, same thing. You were referencing this with, we were talking about Nat Gas and then the coal companies. You were saying when coal was this high. Same thing with oil, right? I mean, you look at the price movement on oil. We've made good money on a lot of all of our oil holdings, but nowhere near as much as you would have thought considering the movement in oil. It seems like we need to get some follow through there. Have you been seeing that as well?
So on oil, I agree with you more than on natural gas. I think a lot of oil names are just nowhere near where they should be. I do think a lot of that's just people are scared to be long it for mandates or for, you know, their clients getting mad, whatever the case may be. And I think that plays a role, but what also plays a role, if you look at the futures curve, like it's $75 right now, but if you look at the 2025 contract, it's $55 roughly. So you're talking about a $20 discount 4 years from now, which seems odd, I think, to a lot of people, but that is keeping. So if you like kind of do, you know, some cash flow analysis in the future, it doesn't look that great. And that's one of the reasons shale is not drilling like crazy, is because if you're trying to sell oil 2, 3, 4 years from now, it just doesn't look that good. And I think that's playing a role. I think that's wildly wrong. I think that's because people still think that the, call it 5 million barrels that OPEC is still holding back will be enough. And I think that's 100% wrong, but the market clearly thinks that's 100% right. So I think when that mispricing changes in the curve out and those out years, you know, whenever those prices start to move higher, that's when I think you see oil stocks kind of start to really react. And kind of same thing, we're talking about, you know, getting high yields. I think that's where you're going to be. You're going to have a lot of dividends. You're going to have a lot of share buybacks. You're going to kind of make your money and shareholder yield more so than the prices going up a lot of times.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, hey, pal, I really appreciate. Oh, one other final thing, really quick. We've got all the indexes hitting new all-time highs. Volume is not very impressive. And I still would say that although they have quote-unquote broken out, it isn't the most convincing. Feel free to let me know if you disagree with that diagnosis. And then also kind of sitting here, my look at this thing is I feel like we need a serious bout of volatility to either smack investors around a little bit, or we're just going to take off and go substantially higher. So since I said that, we'll probably grind sideways. Well, what is your take on the markets overall here, just looking at them on a technical basis?
Yeah, so, I mean, on a technical basis, they look good. There's no two ways about that. I think we're getting a little bit more risk coming in lately just because everyone seems to have a full long position on at this point. There's a lot of positioning and sentiment data that's coming out. And it's just kind of everyone already owns everything. And usually when that happens, you need a bigger washout than we've had recently. So I do think there's some risk there. But personally, like I'm not long or short the indices. Like just don't really see great risk reward in either direction at the moment. But keep an eye on like credit spreads, stuff like that. I think there's a little bit more risk starting to creep in. You know, I watch the cyclicals versus defensives as sort of a little bit of a stoplight almost. And I think it's been flashing green since the market bottomed, and it's starting to kind of flash yellow. So that I find that interesting.
Yeah, that's good stuff, man. Well, hey, Chase, thanks as always for taking the time. I know you got stuff to go to and get to. You're a busy guy. Keep us abreast, man. Keep us informed of what's going on here, and we will keep a close eye on all the stuff we discussed, and give my best to the wife and the little one there, and we will get you back on soon, pal.
All sounds great. We'll do. Take it easy.
All right, you guys. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. That was Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro Research, our macro maven that does everything. He's our go-to guy on the macro side. And he's earned that position. He's made us a lot of money. So anyway, as always, we will be back next week. I believe we've got another interview slated. I got to finalize that, but you're not going to want to miss that one. And as always, sign up for the virtual roadshow coming up July 22nd. Anyway, have a wonderful weekend. We will be back next week. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.